Hello, and welcome to a special Halloween episode of Endeavors. Got two of our favorite horror film icons coming up on today's show. Earlier this year, I got to speak with one of the original Scream Queens, Lynn Shay, about her career and a couple of new projects she has in the works. This is my conversation with Lynn Shay. Lynn Shay, hello, good afternoon. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So your new film is Room for Rent. Now, of course, many people will know you from your work in horror films. You know, you've got Nightmare, you've got Insidious. What was it about this film that attracted you to the role of Joyce?
It was actually Tommy Stovall. I had done a film with him some years ago called Hate Crime. Tommy's a real researcher. I mean, I didn't know him before, and I'm not 100% sure how he found me for Hate Crime, but I know he told me once he had cast me that I resembled this woman who I was playing. I think the character's name is Catherine. That I actually resembled the real woman who the role was patterned after. And so he reached out to me, and I liked the script, and it had a good story. It was with Seth Peterson and Bruce Davison, and it's about a hate crime, a gay couple. And this was some years ago. As we all know, the issues have become much more heated even since then. So it was kind of innovative in that way. It was about a bit still of a taboo subject and religious fanaticism. I mean, it was really a good story, and I believe Tommy, I think Tommy wrote it. I'd have to look, don't quote me on that because I'm not 100% sure, but we shot the film in Sedona. He said, you know, he and his partner Mark lived in Sedona, so we shot it there, and it did very well. It was accepted into quite a few festivals and won some awards, and, you know, and sort of end of story. Tommy is off the grid. He lives in Sedona, doesn't live in Hollywood, doesn't really fraternize he's not that guy. He's a very quiet, sort of introverted person, very thoughtful. So lo and behold, a couple of years later, he said, I've got another script called Sedona that we're going to be shooting in Sedona, obviously, about the kind of crazies who live in Sedona. I guess Sedona sort of catches, it's kind of a panhandle of catching loose souls who aren't sure where they want to be and who are attracted to the vortexes and the sort of mysticism, the mythology of the mysticism that surrounds Sedona with the Red Rock and all that. So he offered me this one role that I wasn't really crazy about, and there was a little tiny role that was not really filled in at all, of a little kind of homeless kind of crazy person, sort of a town crazy. And I came up with this idea, I don't even know where this came from, that she was sort of trapped in her six-year-old birthday, and that she wears a party hat and has a little full skirt with a crinoline, and she has a balloon wrapped around her wrist, and she sings happy birthday to herself and to everybody she meets. And she's a key, she was a key figure in the story. It was with, Beth Grant is in it, and oh my gosh, my brain is fried this morning. Frances Fisher, and there's a plot line where I steal Frances Fisher's car keys, and she's trying to get out of Sedona, and I won't give them back to her. And it's a very kind of fragile, odd story. And I love this character. She really popped. So, long story short, so that one was finished. And then about another year or so goes by, never hear from Tommy, have no idea what he's up to. He says, can I send you this other script? And it was Room for Rent. And when he sent it to me, I read it and I didn't like it. It seemed very routine to me. You sort of knew the beginning of the story. I have to get out of this room because there's a blower going on outside. I'm sorry.
It's all good.
To digress here. Can you hold on one second? I was trying to clear the, because I can't think when there's too many sounds happening. Okay, let me know if I lose you or anything, but this should be better. Because it was about a psychopathic killer and this woman, and I thought, you knew the end of the story at the beginning. So I passed on it, and so a little more time goes by, and it was probably close to another year later, so I don't know the exact. So Tommy said, would you take another look at this script, Room for Rent? So he sent it again, and I reread it, and I still had the same impression that there was nothing new about this story or interesting to me about the character particularly. And kind of on our feet, I said, but what if this woman is not a killer? What if she is a victim, basically, of the way the life she's been forced to lead, that she has no, has never learned how to navigate social interaction or life, really. She does, you know, that her husband has sort of ruled her and kind of held her as captive, almost, to be his slave, you know, except for a sex slave. There was no love in their life particularly at all. I mean she was considered, I think, he kind of considered her his maid, really. And for all those years, she kind of put up with it because she didn't really have any skills to lead. She didn't have, she had never developed in any way as a woman. So I thought that would be a really interesting story, and that it's circumstances that lead her to do bad things, and that's how the script as you see it evolved. And Tommy was really open to the idea, and we kind of redid some dialogue, a lot of the dialogue, and we redid a lot of the storytelling, but mostly, you know, conceived of this very mousy, small character who had no life skills, and how does she handle life afterwards? So that's a long story to tell you a short story, but that was how we finally said yes, and we started working on the material, and I got more and more excited and enthusiastic as it kept growing, and the result is what you see. You know, I love the character, and I guess I'm a little quirky in general. So some of my ideas about her quirkiness are apparently really quirky, which I'm very pleased about.
I know that this film, it was actually the first time you got a producer credit as well.
Yes.
How did you like delving into that world a little bit?
To be honest, I love the creative input. I mean, I love creative input. I love, because my imagination, gratefully, is always active and enriched by all the things I've gotten to do over the years. And so that I was creatively involved in dialogue, storytelling, those ideas, I love it. In terms of the other part of producing, which is more the financial producers who put together the deal, to be honest, I have no idea, and I couldn't care less. I mean, it's nothing I'm good at. I think that's the best way to put it. I care about it, obviously, because it's what gets the film made, and all those elements are complicated to put together and different personalities. I'm actually executive producing, which it's a long, long story too, but another film I'm going to be shooting up in upstate New York in a couple weeks. And I was more privy. I wasn't involved in putting together the finances and all that stuff, but I was involved in the emotionality and the torture, so to speak. I was aware of everything going on, and it's nothing I want to do. I mean, I love being creative and having someone listen to me about my ideas about character and dialogue and story, but the other part is really I'm not good at it. I don't know enough about it. I don't understand those details, and I leave it to the experts to, you know, to cover that part. So I'm always happy, though, to be included in the creative process.
You mentioned that sort of that Tommy lives outside of Hollywood, and you've done both big budget Hollywood films, and you've done a lot of more independent fare, such as Room for Rent. What do you like about working on the smaller films?
What I like about the smaller films is you really do have more input. You know, in other words, when you're working with where there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, where there's a studio especially involved, who has, you know, who wants a certain thing to sell. I mean, the dynamics are so different because the studio is looking for saleability, and they're looking for good, you know, quality product, obviously. But their focus is how much will it make? How many people will want to see this? So their input is often based on what they think is popular and saleable. And the smaller films, you don't have that pressure. You know, you still want to tell a story to people. I mean, obviously, we all want people to go see the movie and want to see it because that's the whole point of making a film and being an artist. You know, the art is not just for you. You want it for the public. So I in some way, it's very fun for me to be able to feel free to participate. I'm just getting ready to do, this will be a new experience for me too. It just got announced yesterday. I'm doing a recurring on a Showtime series. They're doing the fourth season of Penny Dreadful, and it's a fantastic story. It's 10 episodes, and I'm in 6 out of the 10. And this is a whole new group of people. I don't know anybody at Showtime. I don't know the people I'm working with. I don't know the director or writer other than, you know, having met him informally on the phone and stuff. So it's going to be and yet what I got from the writer and creator of this is that he's a real collaborator because he asked me, he said, if you have any ideas, send them on. You know, and that's rare, to be honest, especially not so much in cable television, maybe, because it's a more independent, there's more independent avenues there, but network was very, you know, it's pretty strict. I mean, they have rules, you know, that you got to follow on some level. So I'm looking forward to this new adventure because even though it's sort of a different game in terms of, I mean, Showtime is indeed its own platform, and I'm sure they have parameters too, you know, but they've also got a successful show that we're going to be continuing. So I'm going to be sort of bound, we're bound by those parameters. But I think in general, the idea of filmmaking is if your ideas are not heard, it can be very frustrating and also limiting creatively in terms of what the outcome is and how you participate. I love being able to participate. I've been an actress for 48 years. Can you believe it? I can't believe it. I mean, I'm 146 years old according to my scale. But I realize I'm finally owning the fact I know a lot because I've had a lot of experience. And it doesn't seem that way, though. It really doesn't. It all feels like smoke and mirrors in some regard. And I have to me, it's always the first time. I'm as scared as I ever was, always before I start a project. I'm as nervous and creatively stimulated if it's a good project. I'm very grateful for that. I don't walk through anything, nothing. I mean, I'm in hook, line, and sinker, and I give everything I've got at every moment to every moment. And so, you know, I'm very happy to be a part of any world that will include me. And you know, obviously, if being pulled into this project was based on my previous work. You know, I mean, I didn't audition. It's one of those wonderful moments for an actress when you get hired, you know, and you don't. They want you. You know, they want what you're going to contribute. And I mean, my career is the best it's ever been right this minute. It's crazy.
You know, you mentioned that, sir, you've pulled in a lot, and you've been doing this for 48 years, and you've all, like, at least in the early part of your career, and now later as well, you got this reputation as a scream queen for many of your roles in horror films. Are you okay with that reputation, and do you recall being a fan of horror films early on?
I people ask me that all the time. I'm a fan of story, and genre does not really come into play for me, to be 100% honest. The horror community is very tight and very, it's a fabulous bunch of people, especially here in LA, who are the ones I know, very dedicated, very loyal to each other, love ghost stories. I love stories. I mean, if it's a good story, to me, it's a good story. And I come out of theater. I mean, I did theater. I lived in New York. I'm a member of the Actors Studio. I've studied with Uta Hagen, Stella Adler, and Lee Strasberg. I mean, I went to Columbia in their theater arts program for 3 years and have a master's in acting from Columbia. I mean, I'm a schooled actress. I mean, I really learned how to do my job. And I'm grateful for that because it put me where I am. I mean, it gave me footholds into confidence and into knowing how to work and how to work with people. So being a scream queen, sure, I'll take it. Whatever you want to call me, I don't care.
You know, and
they say, I don't care what you call me as long as you call me.
Right, exactly. You know, and yet a lot of people also know you in the 90s from your work with the Farrelly brothers in three films, by my count. What was your experience working with those two?
Oh, man. They are the best of the best. As we all know, look at Pete. I mean, Pete just won an Academy Award. I mean, oh, my God, are you kidding? You know, I mean, we all don't know too many people that, you know, reach that pinnacle of success in their career. And, I mean, when I did Dumb and Dumber, I mean, this goes back to my brother, Bob Shea, who started New Line Cinema in 1968 in his bedroom in New York City on 2nd Avenue and 13th Street. And it was his office, excuse me. It was his bedroom / office. And he was the one that greenlit Dumb and Dumber. It was New Line that did Dumb and Dumber. And it was because of Bob Shea that I got a role in Dumb and Dumber. He pretended he didn't give it to me, but later I found out that it was him that said, hire my sister. I mean, Bob has been very integral in giving me opportunity. And that was how I met Pete Farrelly. And I worked on that role just like it was a major role. Mrs. Newgaborn, you know, a dog, you go into the details of who is she, what does she wear, how does she fix her hair, how does she deal with her, you know, I mean, I create a whole life for the people I play, even if I have no lines. I mean, I have to, because otherwise I don't feel worthy of walking out on set. And that's also from training. I mean, I have a very strict set of not rules necessarily, but of benchmarks that I have to meet in order to feel comfortable to walk out on set. So, you know, Mrs. Newgaborn, if you look at my hair closely, the top of my hair is like a pom-pom, like a poodle pom-pom. And I told the hairdresser, I said, I want to look like my dog. Because people do look like their dogs, if you notice.
Yeah.
And the part that made Pete notice me, because I was now, I didn't know this when I got to set, but I was Bobby Shea's little sister who they told him to put me in the movie. So, but I said there was the last part of the scene. It's a short little scene, you know, if you recall. It's me and Jeff Daniels, and he's taken my dogs and gotten them all messed up before the dog show at the fast food place. And I open the van, and it says in the script that I scream when I see them. And I said to Pete, what if I don't scream? What if I whimper like a dog? And so I go, oh, 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 and he loved it. And so suddenly he looked at me kind of with new eyes, and he said, that's a great idea. I really like that. And so you could feel this change happen from being Bobby's little sister to a creative actor on set. And that was how I met Pete. And then the Kingpin story is sort of an infamous story at this point. It probably would be as long to tell as the conversation. but they did not want to see me for it. And over a period of 6 weeks, I bought that outfit at a thrift store on Melrose. I worked on the makeup in my bedroom with grease in my hair and stains on my teeth and eyelashes coming out of my nostrils like nose hairs. And finally, literally, and they still refused to give me an audition. They were very nice, but they kept saying, "We love your work, but we really don't think you're right for this role." And so I begged and begged and begged and begged, and at the last moment, I contacted the producer I'd met on Dumb and Dumber, Steve Stabler, who to this day remains a major person in my life because he changed my life by this opportunity. And Steve said, "All right, you put something together, I'll bring you in." And I drove to Santa Monica Boulevard way down near the beach, dressed up exactly as you see me in the movie in that little jumpsuit with my hair greasy and bad teeth and with a cigarette in my mouth. And came into the audition and I sat down. There were no chairs, so I sat down on the floor and Rick Montgomery, who is the wonderful casting director, he walked by me several times, and I thought, this is kind of weird. I had an appointment, I thought. And suddenly I said, "Rick," I said, "hey, it's Lynn." And he said, "Lynn?" He said, "Oh, my God, I thought you were homeless off the street. I was going to call the police." So long story short, I walked into the room, they lost it, and I found out the next day they hired me. And, you know, that's a lesson in persistence, yep. I guess, for anybody listening. You know, you can't. Don't let go of what you love. And I love the whole process I love acting so much. I find it fascinating and stimulating and exciting. And if it's something different for you, if it's about being famous in Hollywood, well, that's fine too, I guess. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. But that's not why I do it.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm more surprised than anybody that I just got hired for a Showtime series without auditioning.
You know, not to get too much off track, but I just want to say that I think one of my favorite roles that I remember you from was the mother in Detroit Rock City.
Oh, me too. And now that was a New Line project also, but I had to audition like crazy for that. And, you know, nothing is really, I mean, things get handed to you, but even the things that get handed to you, you've got to prove you were worthy of having them put in your hand. I mean, you can't just go, nothing's a free ride, really, I don't think. And I was I really feel I have a gift. I mean, and without sounding too corny or egotistical, I just feel like I have something I can do that surprises and inspires me. That's what the most exciting part is, because I never know the answers. I mean, I never walk into a piece of material or a set and know the answer. I know nothing when I walk in there. And I'm just changing my location here again. I'm trying to run away from all the noise. So you have to repeat the question because I just...
Oh, you know, I was just talking about... it was Detroit Rock City.
Right. So when I met Adam Rifkin, you know, so I got cast, and again, we sort of talked a lot about the character, and the fact that I loved the story, I was really interested. I mean, I think it's still a great story, and you know, we Adam and I kind of hashed out the idea that little Farrah Fawcett flip, you know, like what was her hair like, and the houndtooth coat, and you know, what was sort of a period piece in a way. And the guys were great. We shot that in Toronto, by the way.
Yes, that's right. I know some locations were out in the city, and then also out in Scarborough as well.
Right, right.
You mentioned earlier about how, you know, the horror community is very, very tight, and you just talked about inspiration. And given your long career in, you know, in horror movies and in the horror community, how inspiring is it to sometimes, you know, go out and meet the fans and be taken in by their passion for these projects just as much as you are?
It's very exciting because their energy, it transfers to you. And it's sometimes exhausting. I don't do the conventions. I have done a couple in the past. But I enjoy, it's sort of not, I guess I'm not really comfortable doing them completely. And it's not what I'm about. I'm always open to fanship and to, I love it when people recognize me, which is happening more and more. And it's usually at the produce section in Ralph's. It's like, it's usually about Insidious these days, you know, Elise. Or sometimes it's from Kingpin, believe it or not, which is scary, because if I look like that when people see me, I mean, I don't walk around in that outfit. But, you know, there's some demeanor, my voice people recognize some of the time. So I love my fans. I mean, that's why I have a career. You know, if it wasn't for them, I mean, they're part of that saleability thing. You know, they want to see what I'm doing, and it's very exciting and fulfilling to know that they're interested in me and what I'm creating. So I'm a big fan of the fans. I guess that's the best way to put it.
How do you find that horror films have changed over the years? You know, sort of in the early 70s and 80s, we saw a lot of slasher picks, and now we're seeing a little more, not intelligence, that's the wrong word, but a little more thought-provoking in some of the plot lines. Is that something you're conscious of at all?
Yes, I am conscious of it, and I've never been a fan of slasher films. I mean, they just don't appeal to me. And I think still there's that hardcore fan base that likes to see people with their legs sawed off. And I mean, it's just not, you know, even James Wan even saw that, you know, the first one is, I guess, great, but I didn't love watching that, to be honest. I mean, I don't like to see people tortured. It doesn't appeal to me. If it's part of the storyline, of course, it's, you know, then it's real life, too. I mean, unfortunately, there's plenty of torture going on in our world. But in terms of slasher versus intellect, I think it's kind of, it's a little bit of, you know, again, it always boils down to, do you have a good story? You know, is your story interesting enough? And are you going to be engaged by what happens, as opposed to, you know, seeing, you know, people who wait for the head to be chopped off? You know, listen, everybody, it's whatever floats your boat, I guess, on some level. I prefer something that's more intellectually interesting, where, you know, and that's why I like Joyce as well. I think she's not crazy. At least that's not what I thought when I played her. You can think whatever you want. You know, of course, the audience always interprets what they see in their own way. But in my mind, Joyce is a product of circumstance, that it's sort of a decline into madness based on the events in her life. Here's a woman who has no social skills, who has no, has never been treated well. And obviously, when you meet her, she's, you know, we did a lot with wardrobe on that film, you know, trying to show that she had no idea what people wear. She put on something to cover herself, end of story, you know, and a sweater because she was cold. But that that people are driven to things, and I think that kind of horror is much more, for me, is much more powerful and long-living than just imagery of, you know, of decapitated heads and gore. So, personally, I'm not a fan of that kind of horror as much as I am of psychological storytelling.
What I found, what I liked about Joyce and your performance is that you do so much with so little. Like, you can clearly see, the way I interpreted it anyway, was the pain and grief on this woman's face. And yet, I do feel that at times there were maybe some scenes that were more difficult to film than others. Like, I know the scene with Ryan and then the skaters. Was there a moment of yours that was favorite to film, or maybe a moment that was tougher than others?
That was probably the toughest moment for me to film in the whole film, because it's kind of hard to describe, but your body doesn't know you're pretending. You know, I mean, basically, you're pretending as an actor. You're pulling up, you know, thoughts and ideas, but that, you know, the circumstances pretend. It's not real. But you make it real by stimulating thoughts and also the actual physical event of the scene, that the physicality of that scene was very ignited a lot of stuff. I mean, it was crazy. Now, I must say that the early script, the actual script, before I even said yes to it, and this is one of the reasons I actually ended up saying yes to the script, is that where Joyce, after she's been physically sort of accosted by the skateboarder, that she grabs him and kisses him on the mouth. And I remember the rest of the script was very mundane that I read in the beginning. But that scene, I thought, oh, my God, I've never seen that, and what a great choice for a character. And how shocking, you know, for this old lady, basically, to grab this kid and give him, a tongue kiss, basically. I mean, out of frustration and out of not knowing how else to handle the situation. And the violence of the scene was kind of triggered, was a real trigger emotionally for me as well. So it was, it took me a minute when it was over to sort of regroup and come back. You know, it wasn't like, okay, let's move on. You know, I mean, I was physically and emotionally affected by it. And the take they used, you know, there's what they call a stage slap, and it's what they use in films as well. Basically, the person slapping you doesn't really make contact with your face. I mean, you can, but the way it's supposed to be done is it's the person getting hit who, as they use the expression, sells the slap. So it's a kind of crossover of a hit. It looks from camera like they've slapped you in the face, but basically the person getting slapped throws their head back, and it's the amount of velocity that they move their head that makes it sells the slap as being hard or not. And so we rehearsed it a bunch of times. It's a timing thing, you know, like one, two, slap, turn. You know, you kind of, it's almost like a dance. You figure out the movements. Well, I didn't move my head fast enough in the take they took, and he really slugged me. And it hurt, you know, I mean. Yeah. So that was that moment also triggered an emotionality in me. Getting slapped is really an awful feeling. It's humiliating, it hurts, it's degrading, it makes you angry, it makes, you know, I mean, it's it has a whole bunch of stuff attached to it. Now, if the guy hadn't written about kiss, Stuart is his first name, hadn't written about the kiss, you know, there would be another way Joyce could have responded, which is she could have just wilted, you know, because maybe, you know, her husband had hit her. You know, I mean, we actually find out he's an abuser later in the story. But the reaction was what the reaction was, and that was a real true reaction. And I think that was my hardest, and one of it's a hard scene for other people to watch, apparently, as well, I've been told. So.
Definitely, yeah. I know by my count, well, I know you have Penny Dreadfold coming up with Amy Madigan and Brent Spiner, but you have, I think, by my count, 8 films in post-production. There was a couple that I was really interested in. I know one that's, I think, already premiered at, was it South by Southwest? And I know it's had a bit of a long history, but was Killing Winston Jones.
You know what? I don't know what's happening with that. It's kind of a sore point in a way. It has never been really seen.
Yeah.
And it's not anything really to discuss. It was just sort of miscommunication towards the middle and end of the film. And it's a fantastic story. I mean, and Richard Dreyfuss, I play his wife, Madeline, and it's one of my favorite parts ever. And I don't know if anyone will ever see it. I mean, I don't know if it'll ever be released.
That's unfortunate.
It's unfortunate.
The other one that really intrigues me, well, first of all, I love the title, but it must be nice to get to do something lighter, is Max Reload and the Nether Blasters with Kevin Smith and Will Wheaton.
Right. Greg Grunberg is my hero in that one. He asked me to do it. I actually just talked to Greg, and they're still, believe it or not, they're still in post-production on it because they had a lot of special effects stuff because of the video, you know, the video game aspect. But I love, they let me go on that one. And we created, it's a fit. I mean, we had so much fun doing it. It was only a couple days of shooting. But I'm anxious to see how it comes out because I think it'll be, if it works the way they're hoping, you know, sort of engaging the gamers as well as film buffs, I think that'll be a really popular little film. And Kevin Smith is great. And, you know, I didn't get to work with him, but I play Greg Grunberg's mother. So, and she's got a very sharp pink bathrobe. That's all I'll tell you.
Well, I think, you know, given the subject material of this and the cast, you might have a whole new legions of fans after this. All the gamers and the
all
nerds.
The gamers, really?
And,
I'll take it. And they can stop me at the produce section in Ralph's too.
Yeah, you got your gamers, and then you got the fans who are, you know, the people who are fans of blood and gore. So, what do you think, you know, what do you think you want? Oh, and the other sort of one more project I wanted to ask you about, I don't know if you can talk about it, but, I heard you're in a reboot or a remake of The Grudge.
Yes. Yeah, I can talk about that. That is, they're calling it Grudge, not The Grudge, I was told. So I don't know why they changed that, but it's going to be released, I believe, January 6th of next year. Nicholas Pesch is the director, who is an insanely frightening filmmaker and the sweetest guy you've ever met, which is also kind of this odd mix. They're doing a little bit of additional photography, I was told, right now, linking it more to the original Grudge than it was, because it was an independent story that sort of stood on its own but incorporates the same house. Which is in the original Grudge, and I think they're, you know, Sony is distributing it. That'll be a big deal when it's distributed. I think when it's finally shown, that'll have wide distribution. And I have a fabulous role. I mean, you know, you never know how it all cuts together, because this is a series of stories. Also, it's got several storylines that run through it. So I do know what we shot was unbelievably powerful, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I think both horror fans and also just story fans will be really interested in this story. It's very powerful stuff.
Any chance of either another Insidious or another Ouija?
Ouija, I don't know. Insidious, there's a chance. I don't know for sure, but there has been discussion about it. It depends on timing, of course, and I think James, I was told, did a sort of a pass on the story, and but I don't know where it stands officially. You know, I don't know. There's no time frame that was made available or discussed, really, but. You know, with all this franchise stuff, we all know, listen, they're doing Saw 9 now. Did you know that? I mean, the Darren Bousman is directing, with Chris Rock is involved with it, which sounds fabulous. What a great idea that is.
Yeah.
So you know, franchises have all kinds of ways of re-engaging their fan base. And I'm sure Jason Blum, as smart as he is, if he knows he's still got fans who are going to come and pay for Insidious, they'll find a very creative and wonderful way to make fifth one, and I'm available. I'm dead by now for sure. I'm definitely in the further, but I'll show up if they want me.
What are you looking forward to most about working on the Penny Dreadful series?
I think the character is. I mean, I'm a Nazi hunter. How much more wonderful of a description of a character could there possibly be? And also, I'm working with the people, and John Logan, who is the creator. I've never met him in person, but I had one of the best phone calls. His energy just flew through the line of openness, of excitement, of creativity, of what do you think about this? And they sent me wonderful historical information about it takes place in Los Angeles in 1938. And people think LA is like a kind of a boring, Los Angeles is a fascinating city. And that period of time, right at, right sort of in the middle of World War, right during and in the middle of World War II starting, there were Nazis all over the place here. There were ships in our, Nazi ships in our harbors. There were, there was anti-Semitism galore. There was, you know, the Mexican and Hispanic culture was very, very, very present and rich. So it's going to be fantastic storytelling. So I'm really excited. And also Amy Madigan is a wonderful actress. Nathan Lane has always been one of my favorites ever, ever, ever. And that I get to play his pal. I can't even believe that. I'm so excited about it.
And I know you get to work with another convention icon, Brent Spiner, as well. So
right, Brent Spiner as well, of course.
And I know you've done a lot of guest parts in television, but this will be your first sort of recurring multi-episode arc, won't it? Do I have that correct?
I've done very little television. I mean, I've done some, but I've never done a series. I've never, to be honest, I've never really been that interested in network television series stuff. I mean, there's been some wonderful shows. I like doing variety. I don't like limiting my, I don't want to play the same character over and over. This is a different kind of deal because this is also historically accurate in many respects, and also it's also a little bit of fantasy. And to be honest, I haven't seen all the Penny Dreadful series at all, but they were very engaging and very exciting in the format that they used. And it's the same team basically. So yeah, you can definitely say this is my first. I've never done anything for Showtime before either, for any of those platforms. So I'm really excited.
Do you think maybe in the future we could see you on American Horror Story?
You know, so you're not the first person that said that. I don't know. Ryan Murphy's got his gang. You know, I don't know whether he's, you know, I don't know. I've never met him or know him at all. And he sort of has his troupe is the way I sort of see it. So I don't know. I mean, I'd be open to, you know, they're wonderful stories also. Great storytelling. I really am all about storytelling. That's what made me want to be an actress. That's what I did when I was little, even all by myself, to myself. So I'm game for just about anything, you know, that comes my way to evaluate it and see where I'm at in terms of my thought processes and what interests me. And so far, I've been very fortunate. Wonderful stories have come my way and wonderful people. I feel very blessed. That's all I can say.
Is there a story that you like, or something that you haven't done yet that you still want to tell or experience?
I have no idea. I really don't. There's nothing I can say. You know, sometimes I'll read about a character or, you know, and I go, oh, that would be great. We were just looking at that. I kind of resemble Georgia O'Keeffe. In profile, I was looking at this picture, and I said to my manager, that would be an interesting to play that character. So, you know, sometimes I get those kinds of thoughts, but as I was saying to my son last night, you know, you just kind of move through the thing. You try and be as true to yourself as possible in terms of the way you feel and think about things, and you don't have to plan so much. I've never been a planner. My plans don't ever come through, in my opinion. What comes through is what happens on the way. It's like life happens when you're making, what's the John Lennon?
Life happens when you're busy making other plans.
Yeah, and which is exactly right. And that's exactly right. You know, that you can plan all you want, but suddenly you trip over something on the way to the plan that changes your life and becomes a whole nother plan. So I'm open. I try to remain open and interested and curious, and I love being alone also. Like, I love doing nothing and just wandering around in the world a little bit, in my head and in the physical world, and I learn a lot from that as well. So let's see, my favorite expression, I have two favorite expressions, is just the beginning, and let's see what's going to happen next.
Well, you know, who knows? Maybe this role in Penny Dreadful will be a new beginning for you. But we certainly experienced a lot with you throughout your career. Room for Rent is the film. It's a great film. Everyone should check it out. I believe it's on iTunes and VOD already.
And it's on Amazon Prime.
Yes, I believe.
Yeah.
I believe so, it came out a couple weeks ago, yeah.
That's the one I know how to access.
Fair. There we go. It's on all those streaming services, whatever, you know. Lin Che, I can't tell you how much of a pleasure this was speaking with you today.
Well, it was vice versa, Dan. Thank you so much for your time and for your interest, and to the fans out there. I love you all and appreciate you all and appreciate your appreciation of me. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Lin. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
From earlier this year, that was my conversation with Scream Queen Lin Che. When I first moved here to Toronto a couple years ago, I did a big super-duper Halloween show that October. It was close to 2 hours long, and it had four different guests. One of my guests was one of the most iconic horror actors of his generation, especially in later years working with Rob Zombie on Three from Hell. Other films include Death House, Hatchet 3, Bone Tomahawk, Halloween, Dead Man's Hand, Night of the Living Dead, Kill Bill Volume 2, Devil's Rejects, House of a Thousand Corpses, Jackie Brown, The Aftermath, Swashbuckler, Foxy Brown, Mercy Men, and George Lucas's first film, THX 1138, among many, many, many others. He, of course, was Sid Haig. Sid Haig passed away last month on September the 21st at the age of 80. So from 2017, here is my conversation with the legendary Sid Haig. Sid Haig, hello, welcome. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Doing well. It's starting to rain a little bit here, but it's a nice change from the heat, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, I can imagine. We have a lot of that going on.
Yeah, you guys got fires out there, don't you?
Yeah, like crazy.
Well, this is the month of October, of course. It's the month of horror. How do you feel about being referred to as a horror icon?
That term, it doesn't disturb me, okay, but I'm not sure that I really deserve the icon part of it, okay? I think I still have a lot of work left to do before I can get there.
I think a lot of people recognize you because of Captain Spaulding. Why do you think, I mean, this film's only 15 years old or so, but why do you think that character resonated with so many people, specifically within the horror genre?
Because he just doesn't give a damn about anything, okay? And he plays with people's minds. He gets them chuckling and, you know, all that business, and then slams them with something. And I think that's what a lot of people would wish they could do themselves. So they're getting a little vicarious kick through Captain Spaulding.
Given that you had only recently come out of retirement, before you sunk your teeth into that role, what initially attracted you? I know Rob Zombie sent you the script and basically said,
it was yours if you wanted. But what made you decide to take that part?
Well, because I knew I could have so much fun doing it. It was just so crazy that I said, I got to do this.
How much of your sort of second half of your career for the last 20 years or so, how much do you think you owe to either Quentin Tarantino or Rob Zombie for giving you all these exciting roles?
I owe them all the respect that I can give, and I certainly do that, and they've been friendly and friends, okay? So, I owe them whatever I would owe any friend that I have. It's not just a straight business deal, you know? They certainly rejuvenated a career that was already like 30 plus years in the making, because this June of next year will be my 56th year in this business. So, they took me out of the realm of just playing some stupid heavy and enabled me to stretch myself and get things going.
You know, horror fans are some of the most passionate types of fans that we see, and I think a lot of different kind of festivals and conventions prove that. What do you enjoy about working in horror films and the horror genre?
There's a certain amount of freedom there. It's not present in like big budget pictures. I can remember, working in some of the big studios, and you had to have every if, but, and in place, in every speech, and there was no room for wiggle. Independent filmmakers, basically, which is what we're talking about in terms of horror, enjoy that. They enjoy seeing what you can bring to the role, and if it means changing some dialogue, then fine, changing the dialogue, that's the thing that I appreciate, is being able to stretch myself and give you something for your buck.
Do you think the fact that there's a lot more, in a way, there's more restrictions on an independent film because, the budgets are tighter and there's a certain number of shoot days. Does that allow for greater creativity because you're not having to answer to, higher ups or people trying to interfere with the production?
Yeah, it gives you more leeway to explore the character, and even though the shooting schedules are tight, which they have to be because you're shooting on virtually no money, but I'm used to that. I grew up doing Roger Corman films, okay? And certainly budget was the thing that we had to watch out for the whole time, but at the same time, we had the freedom to express ourselves. So I'm kind of used to that. It's not that I don't like restrictions. It's just that they have a tendency to somehow get in the way of a little extra creativity. Because you're only looking at it through the eyes of this big studio producer or whatever. As opposed to a collaborative operation, which is what filmmaking should be. It's a collaboration.
I know, speaking of horror, you've worked with one of the big godfathers of horror, Lon Chaney Jr. What was that experience like for you, just, you know, as an actor and as you know, somebody who was familiar with his work?
Well, for the first 2 days, I couldn't even talk to him because I was totally in awe. Because as a kid, I would go to the Saturday matinees and watch, you know, the Wolfman and, you know, all of that early horror stuff. And now all of a sudden, here I am working. You know, it's like just, it put me off. I was a little stunned, but we became close. He became my mentor. He told me a lot of things that, you know, I should be doing and taking care of myself and things that I should stay away from, and just gave me a whole approach to what it was that I loved doing, and made sure that I could do it for as long as I wanted to.
And then on the flip side, there's sort of the grandmother of all comedians, Lucille Ball. I read that you had an encounter with. What was that like, being in her presence?
That was amazing. She was a workaholic, okay, extremely professional, and she was just very giving in terms of, you know, the give and take of the scene. And the second episode that I did with her, was the first time that Lucy had ever shot on location, and the location was in Los Angeles Airport. Okay, and the shortest day we had was 18 hours, and the last day of shooting was 21. And she was right with it the whole time, and she, you know, she gave me the inspiration to push myself, and she was just absolutely fantastic to work with, and she's a great person. She was a great person.
And you are also in one of my favorite James Bond films, Diamonds Are Forever. The James Bond experience, I mean, at that point it was still relatively new, I think within about 10 years, but being involved in a franchise as big as that, what was that experience?
That was fun and games, man. It was really cool. He was easy to work with. He liked to clown around and have a good time, and it was just wonderful to work on that shoot. You know, we were in Vegas for I don't know how many days, and everything about it was just, it was top notch, because Cubby Broccoli, you know, made sure that everything was right all the time. You know, he was the one who produced all the Bond films. And so, you know, he was there, and his presence was felt, and Connery was so easy to work with. It was great. I had a great time. And besides, I threw the topless lot of wood out the window of the hotel. So how bad could that be?
And if that wasn't enough, you got to work with George Lucas on, I believe it was his debut film on THX. Did you know early on that with George Lucas, he was a special kind of filmmaker?
Yes, because I was involved in that scene in Limbo, which was like that futuristic J.O. situation, and they had rented a rehearsal hall, and he would come in the morning, and he would say, okay, I want you guys to work on this, and then he'd leave, and left it up to us to work things out, and then he'd come back towards the end of the day, and say, okay, show me what you got, and we would, and then he'd tweak this, tweak that, and that was the end of it. So we rehearsed it for a week inside the rehearsal hall, and then we shot it for a week. And it was a great experience. I'd never worked like that before, working without, with the director, but without him you know, present 100% of the time.
How much do you think or find that the industry has changed, you know, in the last 20 years since you re-entered it?
Well, there's been a lot of changes. Technical changes, of course, with, you know, excessive amounts of CGI and casting has become really different because you're basically nowadays you're cast based on your social media numbers. So, you know, that's a big change right there. You know, budgets are smaller and shooting times are shorter and all the rest of it. I mean, I can remember doing a film with Bobby Shaw and James Earl Jones called The Swashbuckler. And we were 2 weeks at the studio, 2 weeks in Cuernavaca, Mexico, which is where the really wealthy Mexicans go to vacation. And then we were 9 weeks in Puerto Vallarta and then 6 more weeks back at the studio. That was back in the day. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I could have gotten used to that kind of schedule real easy, but that's not present anymore.
And of course, another thing that's all the rage now is the convention circuit. I mean, obviously, it's been around for a while, but there's conventions all over the place now. Do you enjoy that aspect of your career and getting to interact with the fans on a more personal level?
If I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't do it. Okay, I enjoy interacting with the fans. They're the people that put food on my table, a roof over my head, clothes on my back. Why would I not want to, you know, have a personal experience with face to face?
Now I know when you in your hiatus, you became a licensed hypnotherapist.
A certified hypnotherapist.
Certified hypnotherapist.
Yeah. In California, they don't license hypnotherapists. They don't have a board for that.
Right.
But I am a certified hypnotherapist.
What interested you about that? And do you think it's because I know it's a very sort of mental occupation? Do you think that's helped at all with maybe the more mental cerebral side of acting?
Well, it could. Basically, I chose that path because I've done a lot of home study in psychology in order to better prepare a character. And I knew that I didn't have 10 years to go back to school to become a psychiatrist. That was crazy because I was married with a family and had to put food on the table.
Right.
But I did find the Hypnosis Motivation Institute, which at the time was the only federally certified school for hypnotherapy, and it was just down the road from me. So I went, applied at the old age that I was. I forget, it was like 20 years ago. I took out a student loan and went back to school, and there you have it.
And I know that you, music was always a big part of your life too. You guys had a hit, I think, in 1958 with the T-Birds.
Yep.
Do you think you'll ever go back into music? Is that something you're still involved in a lot, or is that sort of over and done with?
No, I'm always, somewhat involved in music. I love it. It's a great form of expression, and so you know when the opportunity strikes, and I get involved, that's where we are. And my niche, if you will, is not something that's like real popular right now. But I'm a Delta blues guy. I love all the old blues tunes, and artists, Mud Belly, Muddy Waters, Sonny Terry, Brown McGee, Mike Willie, all those guys.
And I know you, when you were really, really young, you took dance lessons. Are you ever interested in incorporating your dance training at all in a film?
Sure. If there's an opportunity, I would do that. I did some ballroom dancing in an episode of Charlie's Angels. That was fun with Jacqueline Smith.
Nice.
And it comes along. Oh, and of course Lambada, not Lambada, but the Forbidden Dance. I learned how to do Lambada. And so I dancing in that. It happens. It just happens.
I read something, I think, on your website. It was a fake interview with Spalding when he ran for president or was talking about running for president. Do you have any political interest in that regard?
If y'all had voted for me in 08, we wouldn't be in the problem. We'd have the problems that we got now.
Fair enough.
That's all I'm saying.
Fair enough. And I saw something really cool that you're an ordained minister and you actually married a couple earlier this year at a horror festival.
Yeah.
How did that opportunity come to you?
Well, okay. My manager, in 03, wanted to get married, and his wife, suggested that I marry them, so I had to become ordained, and I did it, and performed several weddings. And so far, checking back, they've all worked. They've stuck it out.
Now I know you have a few films in the works. What can you tell us about? I think the three that I read about were High on the Hog, Cynthia, and then there's one called Abruptio. What can you tell us about Cynthia? I know you just play sort of a straight police detective in that.
Yeah, but that's the first time. Okay, so I have to pay attention to the first time I've ever played a homicide detective. So that was interesting. I had to now just look at the other side of everything that I had been doing since then, and it was really very cool. I had a great time doing it.
And I know, is it High on the Hog that I think aren't you working with Robert Englund in one film and Kane Hodder in another? I mean, those are other horror icons. What are they like to collaborate with?
Well, we're all friends, and what you're talking about is Death House.
Death House, right?
Yeah. We're all friends, and we all did the film basically because of Gunnar Hansen. We're all friends of Gunnar's, and we loved him. He's a great guy, and he passed away before the film could be shot. And so we all wanted to do it in memory of him.
And what can you tell us about High on the Hog? I've heard that's sort of another slightly different role for you than maybe what people are used to seeing.
Oh, yeah. I play a farmer. And the farm has been in the family for five generations. And I promised my father that I would never sell out to corporate farmers. And so things getting a little tough, and so I decided to plant some weed in with the corn, and we're making ends meet with that. And along the way, I come across three women who have been abused, terribly abused in one way or another, and I take them in as family, and that's how we operate as a family. And until the DEA shows up and everything turns bad.
And
I'm not going to give you any spoilers.
Fair enough.
and I also would produce on that film.
Did you like that aspect of filmmaking, getting involved in the behind the scenes?
Yeah, I did, because the crew was very energetic. They really wanted to do a good job. They were just a little sketchy on how to go about doing their jobs. And so I went to the executive producer, Kevin Lockhart, and I said, you need to get a producer in here with some organizational skills that can teach these people, what it is that they need to know that they're missing, because they really want to do a good job for you. And he said, well, will you do it? And I said, well, you got my agent's number. And the next day I was a producer on the show. And I held a 3.5-hour production meeting with the department heads and got everybody pointed in the same direction and gave them, step by steps in terms of their preparation for the day's work. And then it's like we hired a whole new crew. All they needed was a little guidance. They had the skills. They just didn't know how to use them.
Yeah.
And so that's what part I played in that.
And finally, I've heard rumblings of a book in the works. Are we going to see a memoir from you in the near future?
And yeah, at some point in time. I made the mistake of putting too much stuff on my plate. And so everything is taking a little longer than it should.
Fair enough.
But the book will be out. The documentary will be out. The cookbook will be out. It'll all happen in time.
Well,
but the thing is, when convention season really hits hard, I'm only home 2 days a week.
Right.
So.
Well, we look forward to all the movies coming out. We look forward to all the future projects coming out. Sid Haig, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Alrighty, have a good one. Cheers.
Okay.
That was my conversation with the late, great Sid Haig from 2017. That does it for me today. Stay tuned on Sunday when my guest will be singer-songwriter Fintan. Thanks for tuning in. Happy Halloween, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.